Coming up on Life is a Festival.
You know, I go to Burning Man and then I realize, I'm like, oh, wait, wow, like that's radical self-expression. Like some spirits are much wilder than me. And it's unfair to impose upon those spirits the conventional wardrobe that I abide by, for example. Why would you want to do that to anyone? I want everybody to fly high, you know? By the way, if you enter Burning Man, there should be like a giant gate, and they should have a plaque on the top, and it should be like, the only people for me are the mad ones. Mad to live, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time. Those who never yawn or say a commonplace thing, but burn, burn, burn like yellow Roman candles exploding like spiders across the stars. I think sometimes freedom means I need to push at the edges of my boundaries and turn myself into something else if that's what I need. And to be able to do that safely and to be able to then be seen by others with loving kindness, I think is just a beautiful thing.
My name is Eamon Armstrong, and this is Life is a Festival. This podcast is a celebration of thinkers and leaders who live their lives with the open-hearted, experimental joy of a festival. Each week, we converse in complete openness, in an ongoing quest to find those boundaries in our being and melt them into lofty horizons. Life is a festival, only to the wise. Hello, my friends and fellow travelers. Welcome back to Life is a Festival. Considering the audience of this particular program, you, dear listener, may well be on your way to Black Rock City, or perhaps packing up all the things that you want to make sure you are not without, or maybe putting fake fur on an electric bike. I don't know what you're doing, but maybe you're going to Burning Man. And if you are, I hope I see you there. So to start today's program, I just want to make a little announcement. I will be giving a talk at Burning Man. On today's program, you'll hear how festivals, Burning Man, psychedelics, and then kink have been a big part of expanding my consciousness. Well, I've never done a public talk about kink, although I've done a number of talks about masculinity and I've done a lot of different conversations about sexuality on this program, but I've never done a public talk about kink. So if you happen to be at Burning Man and you are not too sleepy at 1 p.m. Thursday, I will be giving a talk entitled Every Daddy Needs a Daddy, which is, you have to come and figure out what that means. I mean, I think it's maybe a little self-explanatory, but there's a whole story behind Every Daddy Needs a Daddy. I will be camping with Camp Kiss, which is the camp that I did the Renegade Burn with last year. We are at 645 and C, and that is where I will be hosting this talk. It's at 1 p.m. on Thursday. And I will be releasing more information about that on my Instagram, which is at Eamon Armstrong, Eamon Armstrong. Come by to the Instagram or the talk, or just, you know, be a part of my life as I've been a part of yours. Okay. Welcome to today's show. I'm so excited to have back on the program my friend Jason Silva, who I met at Burning Man 4 years ago. We've done one podcast together called The Wizard of Awe. We'll have the link for that in the show notes. But recently, I was able to catch up with Jason in Amsterdam and talk about festival consciousness, which obviously apropos to my interests. So on the show, we discuss freedom from self-concern and expanded circles of moral concern. We talk about using avatars to explore the brave, reckless gods we truly are. We talk about ontological and peak experience addiction. We explore the predictive brain theory and how to solve all the problems of the world. Spoiler alert, we don't solve any of the problems, but we are optimistic. We explore flow states through festivals, bicycles, and cannabis. We talk a lot about Burning Man and Jason's new home, Amsterdam. And finally, we discuss festival consciousness and how we can grow through fun. And Jason is so eloquent. If you're not familiar with his work, he is an Emmy-nominated and world-renowned TV personality. He's a storyteller, he's a filmmaker, and a sought-after keynote speaker and futurist. He is known for hosting 5 seasons of the Emmy-nominated global hit TV series Brain Games, and his inspirational videos, Shots of Awe, have received over 100 million views on topics such as futurism, technology, creativity, the science of awe, disruptive innovation, relationships, and mental health. And he's also a really sweet dude and has insight on topics far beyond what we'll cover today. So I encourage you to check out his Instagram, and all of this will be in the show notes. So here you go. Here is Jason Silva. Jason, welcome back to Life is a Festival.
Thank you so much.
It's nice to have you back on the show. First time we did the podcast, it was right after we met at Burning Man.
Wow, at your house.
Yeah, at my house in San Francisco.
Yeah, and I remember that.
It's been some years since then. That was 2019. So we've had quite the friendship since then. And I'm sure that your experience and understanding of both Burning Man and similar transformational incubators has evolved. I know it has because we've spoken about it. Mm-hmm. And so it's really exciting to have you back on the show to further excavate both your existing wisdom and what you yourself have probed in the time since we've been together. So thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me back. And I should say that your podcast is one that I return to again and again. The most recent episode that I was listening to was with that woman who was a burner, but also a scholar of transformational festivals. And she pulled like real data on how what happens in these festivals can carry over into the default world or into our everyday life in a form of lasting change, potentially. And it was funny that you told her that you appreciated the data, but that, of course, the felt reality of your direct experience and other people that go to festivals is such that you're like, duh, of course these events can provide healing and can leave us with an afterglow that can seep into our pores and carry over into our sort of everyday life. Perhaps color the banality of the everyday with a little more festival flair, you know?
Well, and that was Dr. Molly Crockett from Crockett Lab, who did a 6-year study over different transformational gatherings, most especially Burning Man. And yeah, it's interesting because it's like that data scratches the surface because they're essentially creating a baseline. Like, yes, this is transformational. Yes, it increases circles of moral concern. So it's not just about the experience of connection with tribe. And yes, these effects are lasting. So we all kind of know that because we're living it. We wouldn't live it if it weren't for that. I mean, yeah, we like to party, but we wouldn't go through the rigmarole of getting our way out to this desert if it just meant that we could pop some Molly and dance to some electronic music. I mean, we can do that around the corner. You know,
this is a very interesting thing. That this repeat that phrase about increasing circles of
Moral concern. Yeah, so what I really liked about her data was that there's a lot of research around identity fusion within groups. And this happens a lot with religious experience or like sports teams. It's a perfect example of that. You fuse with your soccer club. Like you fuse with that identity. And so there's research that supports that. But what you found in her and her team's research, they identify as non-binary. So I want to be mindful of that. What they found with their research, they used particular kind of like economic games, thought games and surveys that are standard for measuring these sorts of things. And they were able to demonstrate that it wasn't simply about, oh, I went to Burning Man, now I love people who go to Burning Man. But that data actually bore out that the experience would expand circles of moral concern in that they cared more about humanity at large after having these experiences, which is one of the markers that they used for transformation.
And I think that that comes from the earth-shattering freedom from obsessive self-concern that characterizes our everyday life. Like, I think we're so stuck in the prison of our self-centeredness. And what's amazing about being cracked open in a place like Burning Man is the kinship and the affinity that it can forge with strangers. My favorite feeling in Burning Man is probably a few hours of mind-blowing cruising across the playa exposed to insane art that is obliterating all my conceptual frameworks about what is normal and what I'm used to seeing and what is possible. And after all that has been shaken up, then I show up at the temple, which, as you know, people set up beautiful shrines. Strangers set up beautiful shrines in honor of people they've lost, people that have died, etc. And so it's this place of collective grief and collective mourning. And so you go there and you're moved immediately, not by something necessarily that you're grieving, but by the universal archetypal grief of the human experience, which, you know, which is not about our self-centered concern, but is about this collective weight of being and the collective weight of mortality and the collective weight of transience and the collective weight of loss. And so it's like, wow, like now we're all grieving together. And what happens is you might catch the gaze of a stranger and feel for a moment like you're mating with their soul. And I'm not saying you're going to go and marry this person necessarily, but it could happen. But the point is you see potential soulmates everywhere and you realize that the stage can be set for soul mating, and that's what we really want in the end. Like, our petty self-concern is really like a side effect of an overactive ego and excessive rumination. But what we really want, I think, is to feel seen and to see others in this open-hearted way that's free of judgment, that's not antagonizing. We're not sizing each other up. It's not a zero-sum game, but it's like, wow, you are so beautiful and I am so beautiful, and how beautiful we all are, and let's just hold each other and cry. Like that feeling, I experienced it at Burning Man, and it's rare for me to feel that around people that I haven't vetted, that I haven't decided that I feel comfortable in, at least in my default consciousness, you know, in order to like meet the needs that I have as an organism in terms of like self-care and rest and the things I want to do and my creative impulses. I tend to like avoid other people so that I can tick the boxes of what I need. But Burning Man feels like a place where I can claim what I need and everybody's in support of me doing what I need because they're doing what they need. And then when we do encounter each other, it's pure I-thou encounters. There's no I-it, there's no instrumentalist encounter, there's no transactional encounters. You're not a person serving a function, you're a being, and I'm a being, and we're being together. And that happens in this domain that's like outside of time and feels like it sort of has a sheen of divinity because it just feels like everything's going to be okay. Like when we see each other like this, death trembles to take us, you know, like it's a moment of eternity. And so loss and transience fall away. And I think that is why people go to these places. And, you know, we could unpack like, well, why does this happen in these spaces? And what are the characteristics of what is forged or what is engendered by setting up this space? And that's, of course, Victor Turner talks about liminality. The Burning Man by design takes you out of time. It takes you out of mechanized cognition. It takes you out of chronos, and it puts you into kairos. So instead of like you orienting your awareness around consensus trance, consensus reality, mechanized clock, life by the clock, time becomes liquid. And so now we're all in the fucking Dr. Seuss book. It's like, it's cartoon consciousness. Oh, the places you'll go. Have you ever seen that Burning Man video? Oh, the places you'll go, where they all read the Dr. Seuss. Anyway, like it's a very similar engine of empathy that gets you past self-concern, that creates that feeling of expanded circle of moral concern, as you say, as when we watch movies. The famous film critic Roger Ebert has this whole thing where he says movies allow you to step into the foot of another person. Like, when do we get to do that? We almost never get to do that. We're all stuck in our own stuff. But sometimes, like, you watch a film and you can be transported. I can experience love and loss and pain and thrills and adventure happening to someone else, but it feels like it happened to me because I fuse. I assume the viewpoint of the other person. And I think what that does is it shows us that awareness and, like, whatever we are in those moments, at least, becomes self-evidently more than our egoic shell and our individual biographical identity.
Yeah, I like the metaphor of psychedelics because I feel like the mechanism of psychedelics on the mind is that it reduces activity in the default mode network, mm-hmm. and creates more activity in regions that don't typically form networks. Mm-hmm. And then I think about that in the context of society. Like we have a default mode network, and that default mode is capitalism. Yes. That default mode is a certain kind of timekeeping. And when we go into the festival space, we're reducing all of that. We're reducing time. As you mentioned, there are I-thou relationships, which are non-transactional for Syed, the relationships, removing the default mode of capitalism. Yeah. And then that creates connections across regions in the social body that wouldn't have been happening otherwise, and create the experience of healing, of liberation, and of modeling what beautiful world we know is possible that could come to be.
Oh, for sure. And I'm not completely in opposition of the default world. I mean, even Burning Man has to be built by specialists. There are experts at building camps, and there are experts at constructing the art, and there are experts at transporting, you know, like specialization in the engine of how we organize ourselves and capitalism is to a degree necessary for things to function. Like we all have to collapse into a specialization and give the gift that we are uniquely able to give and serve and be of service in the way that our expertise and specialization permits. But I think that the problem is when we define ourselves only by our specialization, only by the thing that we do, the role that we enact. Like in the default world, if I'm going to a restaurant, I'm a customer, and the person that brings me the food is the waiter. And if I'm in the Uber, I'm the passenger, and the Uber driver is the Uber driver. But like, how do you describe a person as an Uber driver? Oh, it's just, no, that's my Uber driver. Really? That's not a person that dreams, that has experienced like liminal zone expansion and laughed and cried and assumed the viewpoint. You know what I mean? Like it's just, and Martin Buber, the Jewish mystic, was the one that talked about I, it versus I, thou. And he says, I, it sometimes is necessary. The instrumentalist, the transactional realm, like again, it's how society runs or the underlying mechanics, but we also need to oscillate, like switch over at some point. And allow ourselves to meet in I-thou ways, in non-transactional ways, as full beings. And some say that when the robots take over and they can do all the menial jobs, that all of us are just going to be like festival goers, you know, because we won't have to have specialization anymore. We'll just get to play together with the entirety of our being.
Well, in extending the psychedelic metaphor to what you're saying now, we don't want to be tripping all the time. We don't always want to be high. We don't always want to be in that altered state. True. But what we do want is to be able to dip into that state, to feel that experience, to shake off some of the stuff that's holding us back, and to step back into default reality with a new understanding, and then integrate that into our lives and make our lives better. And so this is where I wanted to touch on this idea of festival consciousness that you were speaking about privately with me. Mm-hmm. The idea that life is not Burning Man and we wouldn't want it to be. It's unsustainable. There's other things we're here to do than Burning Man, but we can bring some of the magic of Burning Man or of festival culture or of psychedelics or of other peak experiences. We can bring them into our lives and in a way kind of like level up the fluidity, the access to flow, the creativity. And you were describing that as kind of a festival mindset or a festival consciousness.
Yeah, it's just, to me, it's the human being without the constraining effects of socialization. And again, this is not dismissing the role that socialization plays in ordering our behavior. I understand the reason for it, so that we can communicate and that we can agree on stuff and that we can work on projects together and play by certain rules. Nonetheless, I think that everything, including socialization, can go, you know, farther than necessary or farther than is useful. Just like the ego has a fantastic usefulness for directing our behavior. But an overactive ego or the obsessive rumination and self-consciousness that underlies OCD, PTSD, anxiety, depression comes from an overactive ego. An ego that's been slayed and then comes back and with hypervigilance. And so you can almost call it an autoimmune disorder of the self. A useful tool is now causing problems. And I think socialization can lead to repression. And when you have creatures like us that are such an amalgamation of symbolic and we're not just literal, we're like symbolic, we're poetic, we're phantasms and dream figures, you know, like not all of us feel that our skin, you know, we're not octopi. We can't show ourselves on our skin. Some of us maybe win the genetic lottery. Some people feel attractive and comfortable as they are. But for way too many people, they feel like what they are is far more expansive than the body they were born with, or the clothing that they're wearing, or the religion or society in which they live, you know? And so you find new ways of costuming yourself in order to express your interiority outside your skin, whether it's through tattoos or piercings or playing with the boundaries of gender identity, or costuming in a more outrageous way. Like when you go to a costume party or a place like Burning Man, why do you take on a playa name? Is it because you don't like yourself in the real world, or because you feel like the self you are in the real world is too limited? It's constraining. And so I think there's a desire, you know, like D.H. Lawrence said, to free the brave, reckless gods that live inside of us. But the brave, reckless gods that live inside of us are fucking shapeshifters. Like they, you know, what, maybe the brave, reckless god that lives inside of me is a pink elephant with a bunch of tattoos on its forehead. Maybe it's whatever it is. Maybe it's hermaphrodite. Maybe it's I want to like put fish gills on my neck so I can breathe underwater. You know, we're seeing this in the metaverse too, you know, which is an electronically mediated version of a festival in the sense that you can adopt an avatar that more appropriately describes your inner life. Maybe like my avatar identity is Dragon Slayer and I look like Falcor in Neverending Story, and that's more me than a self-portrait. I just think that like the permission for people to just use the metaphor or the literal idea of costuming not to disguise themselves, but to reveal themselves is really interesting to me, especially if you think that our essential self is largely symbolic and poetic and not literal, not like my body, my skin tone, my hair type, my gender. No, my symbolic self, my essential essence is more like a dream figure, a phantasm, an avatar, a thing that can shapeshift.
Well, yeah, and what if
this— Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, this is one of my favorite things about festivals, Burning Man, whatever, yeah, this avatarism. And what if it's the case that not only is our essential self a potential shapeshifter, but maybe our essential self is something that is co-created, like the fractaling of life itself. And this comes out of Finite and Infinite Games, this idea that infinite players play in complete openness. It's not openness as in candor, but it's openness as in vulnerability. It's not about showing the fixed self that is always been, but about revealing, and by revealing, co-creating a dynamic self that is yet to be. So when we're in these altered spaces, when we're out of this default norm, we're able to not only show our true selves, but actually discover our true selves, not as a fixed thing that is waiting to be unearthed, but as something that is co-created with our environments in every moment.
Well, of course. I mean, look, the funny thing is that I express myself creatively for a living. At the same time, I actually find myself to be pretty conventional. My playa name is Jason. You know what I mean? Like, largely the default world, I have found a context. I have found a context and a voice that accurately represents my interiority, right? And so there's no cognitive dissonance between how I feel on the inside and what I present on the outside most of the time, at least in my creative work, right? But I'm kind of vanilla. Like, I'm kind of vanilla. You know, I go to Burning Man and then I realize, I'm like, oh, wait, wow, like that's radical self-expression. Like, some spirits are much wilder than me, and it's unfair to impose upon those spirits the conventional wardrobe that I abide by, for example. Why would you want to do that to anyone? I want everybody to fly high. That should be by the way, if you enter Burning Man, there should be like a giant gate, and they should have a plaque on the top, and it should be like, the only people for me are the mad ones. Mad to live, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time, those who never yawn or say a commonplace thing, but burn, 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 like yellow Roman candles exploding like spiders across the stars. I think there was this writer, the San Francisco Chronicle, who once wrote about Burning Man, and he was talking about like the desire to like dance naked and lick the moon. There is this like outrageous need to shake things up and release the Kraken. you're wild, you're free, brave, reckless God. I think sometimes freedom means I need to push at the edges of my boundaries and turn myself into something else if that's what I need. And to be able to do that safely and to be able to then be seen by others with loving kindness, I think is just a beautiful thing.
I think that we often culturally look at transformation as a point A to point B, where there's some transformed self to arrive at and we go through a process. And there's the metaphor of the caterpillar and the butterfly. Like I'm going through a transformational process. I got to go through the cocoon and I've got to go through this darker experience and then I'm going to blossom as this beautiful butterfly. I think that's extraordinarily limiting and unimaginative, that there would be one thing that becomes some other thing. I think constant transformation is really the most edifying way of living. And what I've found in life is that there's always some new edge to explore if you're the type to explore edges. So for me, Burning Man was like, oh my God, there's Burning Man. Who would have thought there's Burning Man? And then there was ayahuasca. And it was like, oh my God, there's ayahuasca. Who would have thought that I could do this? And then in my case, there was kink. And I was like, oh my God, there's this. Who thought that you could do this? And I hope that life never bores us with a lack of edges to expand against, because I think that's the game of life, really. And this idea of healing, I'm going to come to a place that's healed. When really healing is a lot about coming into wholeness, but I don't think that there's a final resting place. I think that it's an ever-expanding sense of being whole, of being healed, of transforming, and that at a certain point, it's extraordinarily important that that's a communal experience, that's emergent amongst the tribe and beyond the tribe, as we were saying earlier, expanding circles of moral concern, that service has to be a part of it too. Because if it's just about me, my personal, my development, my me, my this, my me, my that, myself, self, self, that ends up being the boundary that has to be transcended to be transformed and expanded beyond.
Yeah, I like to be stopped in my tracks. You talk about like discovering Burning Man and then discovering that this was possible. I think that I'm constantly running away from habituation, from jadedness, from what Michael Pollan calls the been theres and seen thats of the adult mind. And in Berkeley, there's a guy called Dacher Kelter who studies positive psychology, studies awe, which is, I think, another hallmark of festivals. Yeah, for me, the description was really accurate. They describe awe as an experience of perceptual expansion, so beholding something that it is of such perceptual vastness that it obliterates your mental models of the world. Because that's what we do. We model the world. We model and mirror the world. And then we rely on those models of the world to orient ourselves in the world, right? We rely on our maps. But when our maps are obliterated, when we face something commensurate to our capacity for wonder, then we're stopped in our tracks. Stupefied amazement. And I think that's what people mean when they, you know, Eric Davis has written about Burning Man and how it becomes really about experience. Like Burning Man is the religion of experience. Henry Wisemeyer is a travel writer who wrote about this. He says, experience is the new faith and we are refugees from the mundane. Which I think rings very true. So it's like the problem with the mundane is that it's enveloped in the judgment of boredom. It's enveloped in a cloak of like banality, of like dismissiveness. Like it's just like, oh, it's just more of this. I don't want to pay attention. It's not interesting. It's the mundane. It's the everyday. It's boring. I'd rather be in my head brooding. But when you are in the thralls of something like that grips you, that you're fully absorbed by an experience, do you notice that all the rumination falls away, all the boredom, all the jadedness, all the chatter like recedes? And what is left instead is virginal experience, or what Michael Pollan calls a sense of first sight unencumbered by knowingness. And so it's a bit like, yeah, it's mind-blowing enthrallment. Or in entrainment, like you're just in it. And the medicine of just being in it, of just having your mind blown to smithereens and then rebuilding it, you know, rebuilding your mental models to make room for this new thing you didn't know was possible, that's what leaves the afterglow. It's the humility and the awe of having your world, or at least the part of you that felt that the world was a boring, jaded place, that you've seen it all before. No, you're a child again, having seen something for the very first time that took your breath away. And I think that's what people want in festivals. I think that's what I want in that festival consciousness. See the outrageous and the beautiful, the sacred and the profane, side by side.
How do you feel about this idea of ontological addiction, or like experience junkies, people who are constantly chasing?
We're all that. That's what we all have in common, you and I at least.
Certainly, but if we're constantly chasing peak experiences, only Hanuman, the Monkey King, can leap from peak to peak. The rest of us, we have to go through the valleys. Yeah. And can it be the case that if we're constantly seeking peaks, then aren't we also widening our valleys? Isn't there a price to pay for all of this hedonistic expansiveness?
Well, I mean, it depends on how you structure your relationship with the sacred. You know, Jamie Wheel would say, what are your protocols and procedures? Are they sustainable? Are they repeatable? Are you crashing and burning? Are you leaving time for recovery and rest? Like, I'm pretty disciplined about my ecstatic practices. And I know the only price to pay really is a 24-hour dip in dopamine, which can be easily managed with a cold plunge and rest and like less stimuli. And then 24 hours later, I'm ready for more. But I think, what is it? Be disciplined and orderly in your life so that you can be violently original in your work, that Flaubert said, especially if your work is the work of the sacred and creativity and finding a deeper way to live that's more intense and so on and so forth. But then you have to go back to fetch water and chop wood and do that like a monk, if that makes sense. Can you pace your burn? Can you spend a week and make sure that you're getting enough sleep, you're getting enough rest? Not every night is the night you're going to peak. Can you do that?
There is a way to do that. And I think that there's a discipline to celebration in a way. There needs to be some kind of structure to allow this kind of expansion. Mm-hmm. So it's not simply that there are no boundaries. Take kink, for example, which you and I have talked about my experience with that a lot. Kink is an extraordinarily boundaried experience to create the safe opportunity to traverse certain boundaries. And I think Burning Man's a similar way. We have a trash fence. You know, so there has to be some boundaries. There has to be some structure.
100%. You need to create the sacred circle. You need to create boundaries around the spaces of no boundary. 100%. It's like the set and setting in any psychoactive experience. Like, you intentionally enter the world, you draw that line in the sand, and you say, within this world, the structures that govern the mechanics of the default world are going to be dissolved, but it's going to happen within this space. We're going to walk into it. We're going to walk out of it. And I think that's how your life doesn't go off the rails just because you have an ecstatic practice of some sort or another. Because the idea is that you can bring back useful tools and lessons to your everyday life. But in the end, at least for me, I don't think there's ever a I'm done. I think the relationship with the ecstatic, the relationship with the unleashing of one's wild, the unleashing of one's like desire to lick the moon and blow one's own mind. I just think that's just like a regular thing that needs to be like discharged, like a regular feeling of release, like moving your bowels. It's just something that needs to be scheduled, you know?
You mentioned tools that you bring in into your life. Could you briefly touch on some tools that you've brought into your life from your trips to the playa?
Yeah. So absolutely. One of the things that I learned at a place like Burning Man was just how much the simple tool of the space and the transportation tool of the bicycle and the omnidirectional freedom that it gives you turns biking through the playa into an experience of like free associational consciousness. I feel like a sense of extended agency, like my mind is flying through the landscape and I can go in any direction. And like the grid of cars and highways and streets vanishes. And it's this feeling of omnidirectional freedom that's facilitated by having a tool like the bicycle. And I fell in love with Amsterdam and also Copenhagen because these are cities built around bicycle infrastructure because they have realized that there's a correlation, not just with bikes being sustainable, but with human well-being. when there's movement, when there's bikes, like humans are just happier than when they're sitting in car traffic, you know. And you pointed out to me that the layout of Burning Man was actually inspired by the horseshoe design of the Amsterdam canals. But I actually had that experience and then decided to buy an apartment in Amsterdam because I was like, wow. People say, you know, once a year they get to come home, right? They say that when they're at Burning Man, once a year. And I'm like, God, once a year? Can't be. Maybe once a year to share it with 70,000 other people. But besides the 70,000 other people, there's real structure behind this freedom. And that structure can be quantified. And I thought a big part of it was the bicycle. I really was. And that was something I took out and I implemented into my life. And even on a Tuesday doing errands, I can ride my bike and listen to music and have a sense of similar flow and ease to when I was at Burning Man. Have that multiple times a week, that kind of release, that kind of flow, that kind of freedom, that kind of being unburdened by the day-to-day responsibilities of life, just like all my problems seeming so long ago and so far away. That's something that I can evoke, or that is evoked through where I've placed myself because of a real insight that I had at that place. At Burning Man.
Well, and thanks to you, I just had a beautiful experience of that today. We biked around Amsterdam, and I didn't really ride bicycles before Burning Man. I have never biked around Amsterdam. Yeah. And what was interesting is that on the bike, you got to show me so much, and we were in conversation moving from different kinds of art spaces to different sorts of landmarks to different kind of nature and that sort of thing. And as
like
you say—
scenes from a movie.
Yeah, yeah. Like
cutting
scenes,
from scene to scene.
And that the bicycle creates a sense of flow through each moment,
yes.
Which is something that we have at Burning Man, something that you showed me you're experiencing here in Amsterdam. And I think what might be helpful for our listeners is, what are some of the tools that you use to optimize for flow? Because flow is a huge part of your ability to create and your ability to create the types of things that touch people so deeply. Mm-hmm. Yes, the bicycle, an extraordinary tool for flow, physically flowing.
Yeah.
Talk to me about flow. How do you cultivate flow in your life?
Yeah, the definition that I like of flow is the one that says that when you're in a state of flow, which I think everybody in a festival is in flow, like for sure. There are degrees of how ecstatic the flow is, but at its most fundamental, action and awareness merges. And so what that means is a kind of feeling of like the mind and body being one and the same, instead of the body going through the motions and the mind being completely absent from the present experience because it's ruminating about some beautiful lady that didn't text you back or whatever the hell's going on. Like, I mean, some would say that flow requires a certain amount of a challenge or a certain amount of novelty that fires up your dopamine, something that like doesn't give you a choice but to engage more deeply with that activity. So risk, physical risk, intense novelty. But also, I think, a certain amount of psychoactive intervention. Like, for example, I'm somebody who's very interested in the relationship between cannabis and flow. I've done a lot of research on this. And one of the hallmarks of mind-altering compounds, and this is something that Oliver Sacks wrote about, many people have written about it, Michael Pollan wrote about it, is the disruption of short-term memory. And Michael Pollan actually wrote about this in the beginning of his book, How to Change Your Mind. He says that the brain's default function is very similar to an artificial intelligence program in that we take in data from the present and quickly cross-process that with data from the past. So the present, compare it with the past, and make a prediction for the immediate future. And we do that all the time. It's like, it's just happening all the time. And that's, of course, because if the bushes are rustling and the last time they rustled, it was a lion, then you must assume that this time it's going to be a lion. So there's an evolutionary adaptive response to a world of uncertainty. That's why we do that. And then he had this great line where he says, the good news is, because of this, you're seldom surprised, i.e. the wrong thing isn't going to come and eat you. But then he says, the bad news is, you're seldom surprised, because it is surprise that grips you. It is surprise that delights you. It is the unexpected that compels you into the present moment. That is the encounter. It's the encounter that you didn't pre-see a mile away and prepared yourself for it to the point that by the time it arrived, It has no delight because it has no surprise. And so what Pollan wrote, and I and many others have written, is that you actually need to, and novelty can do this, and risk can do this, but you have to disrupt the short-term memory. You have to disrupt this process of reading the present, being able to compare it with the past, and making the codec prediction of the immediate future. If you knock offline that ability, that system in the brain through disruption of short-term memory, now what's happening is you are experiencing the present moment and there's a lag between your perceptual experience and the categorizing, labeling, and of course doing that thing of like, and then deciding what it is and what it means and whether it's dangerous and the been there's and seen that's of the adult mind. And so it's like the painter, I don't know if it was Monet or Miro, who said, in order to see something, you have to forget the name of the thing you are seeing. So that's that delay pedal that you're placing. By disrupting the short-term memory, then I'm driving around my bike and suddenly the sun shines through the trees. And instead of like being like, oh, that's the sun shining through the trees, been there, done that. Instead, what happens is I'm surprised by the sudden rays of light beaming through the trees. And then I'm like, surprised how beautiful. And then it's so beautiful. And then I'm like astounded, but you know what I mean? Like I'm experiencing something before I'm labeling it. So I'm having a heightened qualitative intensity. And there's so much pleasure in the having the experience before I can dismiss it or collapse it by labeling it and by deciding whether it's dangerous or not. And so the world, he says, when you disrupt short-term memory and you're in this flow, your pool of sense impressions fills, is flooded, but then empties as quickly as it fills. And so as you move from moment to moment, you forgot the previous moment and you're not anticipating the next moment. So the present becomes eternal. So you're like slicing and cutting between present moments without the same continuity. And so everything that shows up feels delightful and surprising and has a heightened qualitative intensity to it. And when I'm like that, I'm getting pleasure from everything because everything is interesting. Does that make sense? And that's my flow. I hope that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. And there's actually a deeper level to this. Are you familiar with the predictive brain theory? According to the predictive brain theory, you are never experiencing reality. You are experiencing a mental model of reality that is constantly scanning the environment for changes to it. So all you experience that is new is what your brain registers as an affront to the prediction you've made. From that perspective, you're actually never seeing reality. You're only seeing a mental model and over and over again.
You just hit the nail on the head. You said the only thing you register is what's different because your brain is scanning, it's making the model. And so the only thing you'll notice... The only thing you'll notice, look how tragic that is. The only thing you'll notice is what's different. But if you disrupt that system, the predictive brain, if you take that system offline, now everything is new. Now you're noticing everything because everything is different. David Lenzen calls it the dialectical pattern of reconcilable estrangement with everyday perception. He specifically was writing about cannabis, but I think it applies to any altered state experience. So dialectical pattern of reconcilable estrangement means a relationship, a new distance is created between you and that thing. This place, this person, this forest, this beach, this whatever. This distance between you and that concept of what this thing is. And then you get to behold it because you're noticing it. It's become estranged. It's no longer familiar. And it's different. And as you say, the predictive brain theory, you only register what's different. So what happens if you trick your brain to treating everything as different? Now you're seeing everything as if for the first time. A sense of first sight unencumbered by knowingness. Or you might say a sense of first sight unencumbered by the predictive brain. Everything now registers as new. And so it's, to me, that's the Garden of Eden, twice born. If everything registers as new, I'm enthralled in the thralls of the thing. I'm addicted to enthrallment. So I have to intervene to make everything new at least three times a week. 3 times a week, I think I need to make everything new. And then I can be deliberate about it. Like, where do I want to aim my brain? Where do I want to aim my perceptual experience when I'm making everything new again? Sometimes I get high and go to the movies, and I'm astounded by the artistry of a film trailer. Astounded, bro. Like, overwhelmed, transported, moved, impacted by the incredible, like, fusion of image and music. But anything will have that power, right? Even a blade of grass, when given proper attention, becomes a magnificent world in itself. But if we only pay attention to the thing that's new, and if the been there's and seen that's of the adult mind have made everything predictable, then you have to get rid of that system so that everything is new again, so that everything registers as new.
The long-term meditators have kind of hacked that as well, in that through meditation, because I don't know if you're familiar, I know you know about the fMRI scans of people under the influence of LSD. Almost by accident, those were compared with brain scans of long-term meditators, and they found similar lack of activity in the default mode network, more activity across regions that don't create networks, a very similar thing with long-term meditators. And it's interesting, you look at like Ram Dass, a lot of these folks who were, it was first psychedelics, but ultimately where they found the consistent experience of novelty and freshness was through meditation. Ram Dass talks about how he would go to a concert after he'd spent this time meditating. And yeah, the lights were great and the music was great, but also being at the store and selecting a piece of cheese was great, and buying it was great. And all these moments, because all of them are fresh and renewed. And for I think sure. that maybe as we're looking at like, how do we create life more like a festival? What is the discipline necessary to create constant refreshment? And there are technologies like psychotropics that are super helpful for that, but also yoga, meditation, like these things where we're constantly training the brain for presence.
They can bring us low-grade newness, for sure.
You think only low-grade?
Or do
we really have to be like full-on Tibetan lamas to get like the good stuff?
I mean, I know that for me, nothing does it like cannabis in terms of making everything register as new. Everything registers as, wow. Like, it's just, the best description is there's this term that the scientists use, heightened qualitative intensity. So everything registers as more compelling, and it's involuntary. Everything is just more compelling. I mean, the only thing you can steer is where you aim when you're that open and that suggestible and that receptive. But again, you're literally one spot on when you say you're disrupting the prediction, the brain prediction machinery. Because again, if the predictive mechanism of the brain makes it so that the only thing you register is change, and we are creatures that seek comfort anyway, we're just pulling ourselves into a prison of continuity to feel safe, and then robbed of the zest of aliveness because nothing ever changes. And then the changes that do come are the super drastic, tragic changes that we don't want anyway. But what if you can teach yourself to embrace an excitement about noticing things that were seemingly dismissible in their ordinariness and regularly encountering them afresh? So that at the very least, you are like reminded of how much beauty and wonder and fascination there is in the world. And as long as I never run out of things to be fascinated by, I don't have any problems. My only problem is aging and dying. My problem is not that I'll run out of fascination. As long as I have like cannabis and eyes and ears, I'll be fascinated. But it's time, aging, and death that is the only risk to my fascination.
Well, there's another risk. And that's something that I want to end our conversation discussing. And that's the risk to the species itself. That's the risk to the biome. That's the risk to our planet. That's the risk of war, of climate change. A few years ago, I still had this heart song that festivals could change the world. That if we had these personal transformations, they would create ripples out and the world would slowly move into a more awakened state. And I know a lot of people desire that and hope that. where I'm at now is that that process doesn't seem to be happening as fast as the collapse of civilization. And that actually the risk is that all of this transformation, flow, optimization just ends up really being kind of like turning the world into a playground for the self with, yeah, with a bit of like a hyper individualism to it where it's like, sure, I'm transforming and maybe me and my little tribe are ascending to some place. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, this is the hottest summer that there's ever been and the coldest summer that there ever will be. Mm-hmm. And that's continuing to happen. Mm-hmm. And the clock is running. Mm-hmm. So my question, you know, we're talking about expanding circles of moral concern. Yeah. We're talking about transformation that allows us to be more effective for, yeah, everyone and, yeah, supporting everyone. So how do we take these tools, these ways that we have had the privilege to transform and to learn about transformation, and how do we extend this as rapidly as possible to a world where the time seems to be running out?
Well, it's interesting because I have been spending many years being a hyper-enthusiastic spokesperson for exponential technologies. And I think that for those that are not aware, information technology, which is increasingly eating the world, software is eating the world, information technology tends to advance at exponential rates. And most of us are linear thinkers. And so when it feels like an insurmountable problem like climate change will not be solved unless everybody levels up, and how can that happen? The nature of exponential curves is that it can feel like not enough is happening, and all of a sudden, like, it just swings upwards. Like, I often use the example of the smartphone you carry in your pocket is a million times cheaper and a million times smaller and 1,000 times more powerful than it used to be a supercomputer that was $60 million and half a building in size. And so if all information technologies are following those kinds of growth curves, like 30 linear steps gets you to 30, but 30 exponential steps gets you to a billion. Whoa. And if these technologies are scaling exponentially, things like solar energy, renewable energy, like all this stuff follows exponential growth curves. And there's a guy called Jeremy Rifkin has a book called Zero Marginal Cost Society. He says that the price point of all these technologies also eventually goes down to zero as they advance exponentially. And so in some ways, if we had the entrepreneurial vision and will, we don't even need the government support eventually to scale the kinds of technologies that could address those systemic issues that you speak of. I would point people to some of the work at Singularity University where they teach entrepreneurs and different companies about exponential change. When we talk exponentials, things like nanotechnology, where we're talking about patterning atoms the way we pattern ones and zeros in digital technology. So we could potentially program trees, like buildings that grow like trees, for example. Like these kinds of exotic technologies are on the horizon. So like a complete threshold crossing, a singularity in like what's possible when matter becomes a programmable medium. And like Stuart Brand, who wrote the Whole Earth Catalog, has the great line that says, we are as gods and might as well get good at it. We are increasingly having the power of gods in our hands with these technologies, artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, biotechnology. I mean, we just experienced a pandemic and the first vaccines made of software. Like, how incredible is that? And what's yet to come in healthcare because of biotechnology is going to change the world as we know it. But I guess our biggest problem is probably summed up in Edward O. Wilson's line that we have Paleolithic brains, medieval laws, and godlike technology. And so therein lies the issue where it's like, oh, it's our institutions, it's our political system, it's our Paleolithic reptilian brains that are self-sabotaging at this point. But our genius is clear. What we're capable of is nothing short of miraculous. At our best, we are the music makers and we are the dreamers of dreams. And if festivals, at the very least, remind us, you know, like anamnesis, like Jamie Wheel calls it, remember what we forgot, that we are as gods and might as well get good at it, then we have to bring that back and just like set it into motion. At least for me, like my system, how I live and how I operate always has output at the end. And so all of this self-indulgent self-expansion, you know, this desire for novelty or this desire to like tinker with my awareness so that everything registers as new, it heightens appreciation and it heightens my engagement with fascination about everything.
And then I have an urge to share that fascination, which can be about technology, it can be about how we solve the world's problems, but it can also be about how we solve ourselves. And I'm at a place where it's just, you know how they say, what is Jordan Peterson? I'm sure there's a lot of people who don't like him, but he has this thing where he's first fix your room before you like fix the world, you know? And so I have found that often it is through the work of intervening in our own consciousness to get past ourselves, see everything else, become excited by the wonders, take delight in all the weird and wonderful things that exist and that we are capable of, and then become a cheerleader for putting those things to work in addressing the challenges of humanity and then unleashing the free, brave, reckless gods that live inside of us. So it really becomes a call to action fueled by ecstasy and delight.
I believe it. And there's no sense not to try. There's this idea of the twin path, which is like the outer work and the inner work. And you don't want to get too stuck in the inner work that you're not affecting the world. But if you're just trying to affect the world and you're not doing the inner work, you're going to burn out. And so I think like festivals are places where we can do that inner work and we can do that community work and we can learn things and we can share things and we can teach things. And hopefully festivals themselves will become an exponential technology in service of humanity's self-preservation.
And of course, and I should say that the whole idea of festival consciousness, I'm calling it festival consciousness because a festival is the grandest scaled up expression of a way of being. But I can have festival consciousness with one friend on a bike ride, navigating across a beautiful landscape while listening to Hans Zimmer. I can evoke that. You know, I often also call it free associational consciousness or cinematic consciousness. Here's how Aldous Huxley describes it. Engage with everything, with things in the world, in all of their suchness. That means that like a duck, a tree, a cloud, a song, a film, a micro expression on your friend's face, a sunset, everything blazes. Everything is blazing with astonishment. And that sense of like contemplating the suchness of a thing. I mean, it sounds like a semantic error. What do you mean the suchness of a dog? There's a dog. No, but there's the suchness of a dog. Like the suchness is where the thing and the concept of the thing meet. And then that makes you like contemplate the thing, appreciate the thing, see the thing in all of its thingness. Why do we go to museums? To see things in all of their suchness. Ordinary things hung on the wall all of a sudden can be seen in all of their suchness and can now be appreciated and probed and contemplated. There's a great book by Alvin Noe called Strange Tools. And he talks about how we use different tools to organize ourselves in different ways so that we can look at ourselves from different vantage points, like something like that. I'm not explaining it well, but yeah, he talks about this relationship of like organizing ourselves so that we can look at ourselves in all of our own suchness. He uses an example of choreography. Choreography is an art that allows us to think about dancing, for example. And so you could argue that the festival consciousness is a way of enacting a performative way of being that allows us to see ourselves in all of our suchness. And that is what can then be spill over when we're not in the throngs of our suchness, but we're back in the transactional world or the default world, but that now we can then realize that that default world is not fixed because we've probed and played and inverted in a topsy-turvy way all of it. We've looked at our suchness and inverted our suchness and contemplated our suchness, and so that means that maybe the world can change. Maybe the world isn't fixed. Maybe the world is more malleable than we thought it was. Maybe we're capable of more than we thought we were. And so, yeah, that's I think what is ultimately the takeaway of all of that. And the good news is that we also get a lot of pleasure from this experience. Doing this work is actually ecstatic. It's not martyrdom. Mm. Festival consciousness is a way to grow through fun.
Ooh, I like that line. Jason, I'm going to release this at such a time that people may be listening to it on their journey to the playa. And hopefully you'll be there with us. I know you haven't quite made up your mind yet whether you're coming to Burning Man. Mm-hmm. But with keeping in mind the fact that there will be folks listening to this who are packing for Burning Man, who are on their way, people who are about to go on the annual pilgrimage to the Black Rock Desert to experience what I feel is the purest form of this kind of ultimate presence in the context of a gathering. What do you have to say to those off to the desert before they step into the dust? What advice do you have? What words of solace or encouragement would you give them to maximize their experience of touching this festival consciousness and then bringing it home with them?
Make sure you carve ample time to go get lost in the playa. Don't have a map. Take one or two friends and make new friends when you're there. When you meet strangers, ask them really intimate questions right off the bat. You know, if you encounter a stranger next to an outrageous work of art, be like, "Good morning. So what kind of ache are you looking to absolve yourself from as you contemplate this marvelous, expressive instantiation of human creativity?" Get some really good questions to probe people with.
Good questions can be gifts, can yes. be a way of giving to the planet to have those good true. Questions.
That's very true. Yeah. Ask people what they're grieving. What are they letting go of and what are they beginning? What are they looking to begin to change or to shift? I feel like Burning Man is a great accelerant, and that's a great chance to be reminded of the treasures of being that exist past the default world, and that the default world itself is just an illusion. We're holding ourselves in place with guardrails that served us at some point, but that can be modified and upgraded at any time if we just realize that we have causal agency, you know?
Jason, thank you for coming back on the show.
And, thank you, man.
And thank you for all of the voice notes that we share that the listeners are not privy to, but where we share our own ideas and philosophies over the past few years. It's been really meant a lot to me to be in contact with you, even though we're in distant corners of the world. And I really appreciate it.
Thank you for receiving them.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Where can our listeners check you out? I know many are familiar with your work, but where would you like to direct them?
Instagram is good. At Jason L. Silva. That's where I post the most. I'm on all the stuff, but check out my Instagram if you want to keep up with the latest.
Well, we'll have all the stuff in the show notes. Thanks so much, Jason. It's so good to see you.
Thank you, man. Cheers.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you like the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.